All right, well, coming up this Friday is the 2017 Risa K. Lambert Chicago Luncheon. It's a fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum at the Sheraton Hotel. It's one of the biggest fundraisers for the museum in the entire country. Over 2,000 people are expected, and the event's also expected to raise over $5 million. The luncheon is called What You Do Matters, and the keynote speaker is none other than Iranian-Canadian filmmaker, journalist, and human rights activist Mazyar Bahari. Bahari is well known for the story of being imprisoned in Iran while covering the 2009 elections for Newsweek magazine. He was accused of being a spy and bearing witness to a crime. What does that mean? Well, it means Bahari was present in covering the violent street protests, and that was enough for authorities to put him in prison in solitary confinement, to torture him, and to coerce a false confession. He told his story in his memoir, Then They Came For Me, and that memoir was turned into the 2014 film Rosewater, which was produced by Jon Stewart. Even after that experience, Bahari continues to be a witness and to use his filmmaking as a tool for justice. He founded Journalism is Not a Crime, a project that sheds lights on the journalists that have been jailed in Iran. He also is the founder of Iran Wire, a citizen journalism news site. And his latest film is called Crime and Denial, a documentary focusing on Iranian regime's denial of the Holocaust. It's the only country in the world publicly to do so. It's my pleasure to welcome Mazyar Bahari to the big table tonight. Mazyar, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Very nice to be here.
Nice to meet you.
It's a little bit intimidating to be in the fishbowl with everyone looking into the studio, but I'll try my best to.
That's what the bright lights are for, right? There you go. So you're in town to do the keynote for this luncheon, a fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Museum.
Yes.
Big deal. But this is really about your work that you've done, and you've done it for your whole career, but to really sort of highlight some of the atrocities around the narrative. I mean, the Iranian regime's narrative of the Holocaust and denying the Holocaust ever existed is dumbfounding. I mean, it's one of these that continues to kind of go unchecked in our world. What is it about this story that attracted you to turn your lens towards it?
Well, I may be the first technically Muslim. I say technically Muslim because I'm from a Muslim background, but I'm not a practicing Muslim. I'm the first Muslim who's ever made a film about the Holocaust, of course, sympathetic to the Holocaust. In 1994, The Voyage of the St. Louis, which I made when I was studying in Canada. Mm-hmm. And to me, of course, like millions of other people, Holocaust is one of the worst tragedies of modern history or history of mankind, and we have to learn a lot from that tragedy. We have to learn a lot from what led to Hitler's rise to power. We have to learn about the collaborators of the Nazi regime in different countries. And we have to make the lessons of Holocaust somehow relevant to our time.
Right.
So I tried to do that in 1994. As you remember, there were many Haitian refugees coming to this country at that time. And then, as now, many people were saying that these people are criminals and they are carrying diseases and they should be banned. And of course, 20 years later, many of those Haitian refugees, now very successful American citizens, and even Republican candidate Donald Trump went to Little Haiti last year and said that I'm very proud of the Haitian community and I'm very supportive of the Haitian community. I'm not sure what Donald Trump would say in 1994 when the Haitians were trying to come to this country.
Yeah, so, it's all about perspective. You see it over and over in politics. It's just perspective.
Yeah, but I think the lesson of the Holocaust, the lesson that we have to learn from the Holocaust is not to repeat the history or not allow the history to be repeated. And I think it's up to us as individuals to do that. And I think it's my duty as a human being, first of all, but also as a journalist and filmmaker to raise awareness about the Holocaust.
I mean, for you, and it's such an interesting story because the idea of, it's not just one, I mean, I guess it's all one regime, but Iranian regimes over time have continued this, and it continues today, this denial that it ever existed. And it seems to be much more about propaganda or political advantage or anything in that area than it is about sort of washing history. But how do you get through to an Iranian population, mostly Muslim, that's only heard one story from their regime for years and years and years, to provide them facts and to say the rest of the world believes, or doesn't believe, knows, yeah, you know, has these facts in front of them.
To start with, we have to understand that anti-Semitism is a Western phenomenon. And Iranian anti-Semites and Holocaust deniers, they are using Western anti-Semitic literature, works of David Irving, Roger Garrity, and people like that. So you have to somehow dissect the Holocaust denial for people of Iran. And fortunately, we are living in the era of social media, and when, you know, there are lots of digital media, satellite media, and we can communicate with people inside Iran from the outside. Maybe what I'm doing now would not be possible 20 years ago, before the advent of the internet and social media. But now you can communicate with people directly in Iran. So you look at the facts. You give people the facts. In the film that we made about the Holocaust, we talked to Holocaust survivors. One of them was in Auschwitz. There is a picture of her in Auschwitz. So if you don't want to believe her words, you know, you're in denial. You're in denial of history.
The film you did, the Crime and Denial film, that is not for me. I mean, I understand. I saw exactly. it. I'm like, well, this is something that I've learned from the get-go in America about this. This is really for Iranian Muslim population that's never seen these pictures, never seen or heard this narrative.
Exactly. I think we have to have a new approach to educating Holocaust and to Holocaust education all around the world, because what may be needed in schools in America, with all the free media and many Holocaust films available to people, is different from some countries in the Middle East in different languages. So what we tried to do was to find the areas that the Iranian government talks about, and also sometimes do the myth busting in terms of Aryan nations, for example, because the Iranian government, on one hand, it calls itself Muslim and it calls itself the motherland of Muslim nations and supports the Palestinian causes. But at the same time, it calls itself a part of the Aryan race. You know, Iran means the land of Aryans. And even Ahmadinejad, in I think it was about 10 years ago, wrote a letter to Angela Merkel saying that Iran and Germany, as two Aryan countries, have to cooperate with each other.
What a contrast.
It's just idiotic. It's, you know, to tell you the truth, much of what I do is for selfish reasons, because I don't want to be ashamed of being Iranian. And Iran is not this government. Iran is not Ahmadinejad or Ayatollah Khamenei. Iran is a country that has hosted Jews for 2,500 years. Iranian king, Persian king Cyrus the Great, is called the Messiah in Bible. And Iranian diplomats during the Second World War helped Iranian Jews and non-Iranian Jews. Yeah. And Iran hosted hundreds of Jewish refugees, or thousands of refugees, during the Second World War. So that is the Iran that I want to represent, and that's the image of that Iran that I want to show.
Well, let's continue to talk about that image of Iran. We're talking with Maziar Bahari, the Iranian-Canadian filmmaker, journalist, human rights activist. He's the keynote speaker at a fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum this Friday. It's a luncheon, the 2017 Risa K. Lambert Chicago Luncheon. It's at the Sheraton Hotel. It's going to be called What You Do Matters. It's coming up on Friday. Maziar Bahari, my guest tonight at the big table. Let's take a break. Stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight at the big table, longtime filmmaker, journalist, human rights activist, Maziar Bahari. His memoir, which is Then They Came For Me, was made into the 2014 film Rosewater, which was produced by Jon Stewart. It was a story of covering the 2009 elections in Iran, and found himself in an Iranian prison for the better part of 2009 for bearing witness to crime. I mean, am I saying that right? The bearing witness to a crime? I mean, is that
the... Well, it was a very complicated scenario that the Revolutionary Guards who arrested me, even they didn't know what was going on. Their initial idea was to incriminate a group of people within the Iranian government, the reformists, through my confessions. So as I mentioned in the book, my interrogations were really not about what I did,
right,
but they were forcing me to say what they wanted me to
they
say.
They needed a narrative. They needed to say that the Western journalists were corrupting
exactly.
the street protests. They're the ones causing these protests.
That the Western journalists, the people who work for Western media, they are spies. And they are, you know, that the Western media is part of the intelligence apparatus of the United States. And I think they look at the Iranian government and many of the news agencies in Iran, many the television, radio television, it's according to the constitution, yeah. it has to be a state radio television. And many of the newspapers, they belong to Revolutionary Guards or different branches of the government. So they think that it's the same situation in the United States. The idea of free press does not mean anything to them.
And I want to get to the, we'll talk about free press and the idea of what's happening in this country and sort of the vilifying of the president.
What is happening? What is this?
Right. But I want to watch the movie this morning, just Rosewater, and one of the striking scenes, and it's accurate from the memoir, is the idea of your interrogator having a sort of stereotype of what Americans were like. I mean, he was trying to paint you out to be a sympathizer. He was trying to get you to confess that you were sure. you were doing illicit Western things. I mean, but really, with the thing we pull out of that scene is that the idea of what America is. I mean, even the clip where he pulls up a clip from the Daily Show. You were on the Daily
yeah.
Show, and says, "What is this? I don't understand. This says you're a spy," which you could tell from the joke. I mean, there's a lot of misunderstanding that's happening.
Exactly. Before I was arrested, I was interviewed by the Daily Show, and the correspondent, the quote-unquote correspondent, Jason Jones, pretended to be a spy. And the interrogator didn't find it very funny. I mean, didn't understand the humor. So he thought that he had an evidence that I had met a spy. So why a spy would be filming a meeting? That was, irrelevant for him. He
right.
just thought that he had an evidence. So I think bigotry, I think zealotry and ignorance is not the really monopoly of one nation or the other. I mean, I was just watching the images of Charlottesville the other day, and, you know, those people, what they did was repulsive, but they also looked really repulsive. And they were just saying, "Jews will not replace us." And I was just thinking that I don't know of any Jew who want to replace you guys specifically. I mean, I know many Jewish people, and I don't know many of them who want to live in trailer parks, or you want to have, you know, a relationship with their sisters. It's just that they don't want to choose. I think if I were a Jew looking at those images, I would say,
right.
I don't want to replace you.
But it is interesting. You know, yeah. My
interrogator is an Iranian version of those guys in Charlottesville.
You know, it's interesting because I think between these two countries, America and Iran, there's a lot of misunderstanding. I think that we get all of our... I can only speak for myself. I'm even a talk show host. I'm well-read. I'm paying attention to stuff. But I get my stuff from what the president says or the State Department says or what the newspaper might write about. I have an understanding of Iran is that they hate Americans, that they hate Israel, that they are, if I listen to President Trump, a threat to the Western world. Mm-hmm. You know, and even right before we went to the break, you talk about just sort of wanting to represent Iran and the culture in the right way. You know, I mean, do you see that in your travels? I mean, the idea that Americans are as guilty as Iranians are when it comes to sort of typecasting the countries?
I think it's a very complex issue. I think some of it has to do with the nature of media, and some of it has to do with the nature of the 24-hour cycle of media, that they have to report the first thing that comes to their mind. So when they see Ahmadinejad denying the Holocaust, they report that. they don't have the time even to research and go back to, you know, Iranian history, even Iranian recent history that Iranians helped Jews and, you know, they portray Iran as an anti-Semitic nation. But, you know, there are other publications, I don't know, New Yorker or New York Review of Books that do a more in-depth material. But how many people read New Yorker or New York Review of Books compared to CNN or Fox News? And I think it's in a similar vein, it's the same thing in Iran that the Iran state media, radio and television portray America and Israel as the great Satan and the not so great Satan. And many people are brainwashed. But I think it's, and I have to emphasize on the role of the individual, which is really the message of this launch as well, that, you know, that we as individuals, we have to do our best to inform other people. And we have to use this opportunity now. We have the social media. Each person can be a medium himself or herself. And we have to use social media in order to enlighten people, to tell people the truth. And, you know, and also I find, I mean, I think that I have to portray a different image of Iran as much as possible, because Iran is really not a country that this government represents.
Yeah, and I mean, the problem is with the memoir and the film. I mean, you're talking about things that are right up America's alley. This idea that you're imprisoned wrongly, you know, for freedoms that we have here in the country, and you don't in Iran. So it almost plays to that in this way that, I mean, when watching Rosewater today, I was like, I'm glad that can't happen to me. I mean, it can in America, but I'm glad. I mean, I automatically think that this is some far off place.
Also, the other thing that I want to tell people about the Holocaust is that the Holocaust, one of the tragedies of Holocaust is this cost of discrimination, cost of discriminating against Jews in Germany. When you think about the contribution of the Jewish community to humanity, to civilizations all around the world, and when you think about the potential that those 6 million people had in Europe to contribute to their societies, it's just mind-boggling what the Nazis deprived Europe and generations of people of. And I think, again, in Iran, there are many people who are discriminated against. We are not very far from the Baha'i Temple, which is north of Chicago in Wilmette. And the Baha'is of Iran are denied of, which is, for people who don't know, it's the largest religious minority. It's a new religion. And the Baha'is are denied of the right to education, the right of employment. And the Baha'is are forced to come outside of Iran, and there are many successful doctors, Baha'i doctors and engineers who live in the U.S., Canada, or many different places in Europe, and they're contributing to that society. But they love Iran, and they would have loved to go back to Iran and serve their country. So one of the things that I like to tell Iranian people, and also the Iranian government, is this cost of discrimination, that discriminating against any group not only causes damage to that specific group, but also to all. And I think in this country, in the United States, that is very relevant.
Well, it's happening. I mean, we see it play out on the discrimination in Chicago, and we see it happening in the cost of segregation. We've talked about segregation in this time. So, I mean, there's similar things happening in different countries, but the same sort of human issues that we all can relate to.
And going back to the Holocaust, and that's why the Holocaust and the lessons of Holocaust is so important. We have to learn it, and we have to teach it as much as possible.
Let's do this. Let's take a break so we get tonight's news, and we'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Maziar Bahari, the Iranian-Canadian filmmaker, journalist, human rights activist, is the keynote speaker at the What You Do Matters luncheon, the Risa K. Lambert Chicago luncheon fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. It's going to be at the Sheraton Hotel on Friday lunchtime. We will continue our conversation with Maziar Bahari right after the news here on The Download. Stay with us. All right, thanks, Rob. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Maziar Bahari, the Iranian-Canadian filmmaker, journalist, human rights activist. He's got a litany of things that he's up to, a ton of projects, including being the keynote speaker here in Chicago for the Risa K. Lambert Chicago Luncheon, the fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. It's going to be at the Sheraton Hotel on Friday. The biggest fundraiser for the museum in the entire country.
It is.
It's
yes.
amazing to think about. I mean, because this is for the National Museum in D.C.
In Washington,
but
yes.
they come to Chicago and they say over 2,000 people expected, over $5 million raised coming up here on Friday.
Yes, it's a very important event. And I'm really honored to be the keynote speaker.
I mean, it is interesting because, I mean, you are Muslim. I mean, you're not, as you mentioned earlier, not practicing in religion.
Technically but, Muslim.
And you know, in 1994, you did the documentary on the Holocaust. And that actually came up in the interrogation. The Iranian guard, the Revolutionary Guard, they said, why are you a sympathizer?
Yeah.
They questioned why you were involved in it. It actually worked against you in that case.
Basically, what happened was that the film, The Voyage of the St. Louis, which was the story of a group of Jewish immigrants who were supposed to come to the U.S. and Canada, and then they were denied entry and went back to Europe, and many of them died during the Holocaust. I made that film, and when the film was shown all around the world, and whenever I was doing interviews for the film, I was saying that one of the reasons that I'm doing this film is that I want to tell the world that not all Iranians are fanatic Muslims, and there are some Iranians who care about others. And in 1994, you remember that it was only a decade after the hostage taking, so there was a really, really negative media attention to Iran. So, fast forward 20 years later when I was arrested in Iran in 2009, 15 years later when I was arrested in Iran in 2009, my interrogator showed me those interviews and said that, you know, you're a Zionist sympathizer and you're an Israeli spy trying to infiltrate into our government.
The story that was made into the movie Rosewater and as well as part of your memoir was in 2009 covering the election in Iran and the protests, the subsequent protests afterwards. You were arrested on saying that they accused you of being a spy. You were
not a spy, they told me. I mean, this is how ridiculous it was that the first day they said that you're spying for four different spy agencies, the CIA, the British MI6, the Israeli Mossad, and Newsweek. And I said, do you mean Newsweek, the magazine?
The magazine
said,
I work for.
No, there is no magazine. It's a part of the intelligence apparatus.
In that moment, I mean, it's explained well in the film and in the memoir as well, but here, talk about that. I mean, for you to be in that position where this is different than, it's interesting, we had somebody on earlier in the week yesterday who talking about his experience of being wrongly incarcerated in Brooklyn. And working for legal, you know, lawyers trying to help him out and holding out hope. In your case, in famed prison in Iran, take us back to 2009. Are you optimistic that this will be figured out? That this is they got the wrong guy. I'm not a spy. Are you smart enough to know in that moment that this could be the end of your life?
The thing is that when you go to a solitary confinement, the whole purpose of being in solitary confinement is to deprive you of all your senses. You cannot see anything except for the walls around you. You cannot touch anything except for the walls around you. So you really feel numb and you start to hallucinate and you become vulnerable. You become vulnerable to your interrogator because he's the only person between you and the outside world. And he basically is in charge of your life. So there were moments that I was really suicidal in a sense. I was really depressed. And also when you are in Evin prison in Iran, when you know that thousands of innocent people have died there, their threat that they're going to kill you is just not
a threat.
Just not a threat. It comes in the context of that history.
In the memoir and the film, you talk about the conflict of wanting to stay true to the truth, and you're a journalist, you're not a spy, and wanting to get out. And, you know, that's all they want. They were saying, we can get out of here if you just go in front of the cameras and say that you're helping out the Western world and you caused all these protests, you and others. Yeah. I mean, at a certain point, you had to make that decision.
Exactly. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book and I worked with Jon Stewart to make the film was to tell the truth about journalism, that yes, there are some journalists who are not doing their job, but there are many people in different professions who are not doing their jobs. There are many doctors or lawyers, whatever. But there are thousands of journalists all around the world who are endangering their lives in order to inform people. The Nazis called journalists the lying press, the fake news. And what are we hearing now from some people in this country and in Europe as well? They call journalists who are doing their jobs, who are endangering their lives, mm-hmm. fake news as well. And I think it's, again, going back to the Holocaust where we started, it is very important to understand the value of information, of correct information, and informing people. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you have to just tell people the truth and try to give people the facts and figures as much as possible.
But you, I mean, and you do this with also Journalism Not a Crime. I mean, you have been at the front lines of this fight, where you have said, "Hey, I will tell the truth regardless of what government wants from me or wants me to do." I mean, to the point of putting yourself in harm's way. I mean, there's a scene in the film where they say, "You really want to do this?" You know, and the next moment you're in solitary confinement. This idea, there's a difference between sort of running into harm's way and another in sort of doing this job and being able to deliver the facts in this way in which there are some countries and some parts of this world that just don't honor freedom of the press.
Well, every profession comes with a hazard. This is part of the professional hazard that, if you're a firefighter and you're fighting fires, small fires on a regular basis, maybe for 20 years, and then you're confronting a big fire, as a professional firefighter, you have to do that. It's the same thing with journalism, that you're working as a journalist, you try to give people the truth. And sometimes there is a bigger truth that you feel responsible to do that. So I think I'm very lucky as well that I had that attention paid to me, because I was working for Newsweek, which at that time belonged to Washington Post Company. So some people knew my name. I had friends and colleagues outside
Hillary
of
Clinton,
Iran who had an amazing, who staged an amazing campaign for me. But many of my friends inside Iran and other parts of the world, they do not have attention. They're not as lucky as I was. So again, when I came out of prison, I thought it was my responsibility to do something for those people, to give those numbers. Because when we hear that, for example, 60 journalists are in prison in Turkey, 50 journalists are in prison in Iran, 40 journalists in China. These are not numbers. These are people with families, with loved ones, with histories. So what we try to do in the campaign that you mentioned, Journalism Is Not a Crime, is to give a face and a biography to these numbers and make people care about them.
Mazar, has it changed? I mean, in 2017, I mean, this story was 2009, but I mean, you've been dealing with this for your entire journalistic career. Do you see in 2017 that countries and authoritarians and others are having a different look at journalists, or is it getting worse?
I think it's getting worse, because when I was working, I worked in a lot in Iraq in between 2003 and 2007. And there was always danger that you could be kidnapped and you could be accidentally kidnapped or you could be accidentally shot. But now it has changed. Journalists have become targets in many countries. ISIS is making journalists a target. In many different countries, even in some democracies, when you look at the number of whistleblowers in different countries who've been arrested, you see that journalists have become targets. I think with the explosion of this of digital media, with all the information around us, I think intelligence organizations, governments do not know what to do. And the most expedient thing to do is to resort to the old, same old methods of arrest and incarceration and interrogations. And of course, in this country or in other democratic countries, there is a system of checks and balances. But in countries like Egypt, in Eritrea, Ethiopia, China, Russia, they're targeting journalists. In Iran, it's the same thing.
You see now in the United States of America, and you living in London, being in the States as well. I mean, getting this opportunity to see how journalism is being viewed, not only from the government, but from the people coming up and hashtags, not believing the media, not believing journalists, the profession, if you put it on the list of the top, it's always at the bottom. I mean, do you see in a country that honors freedom of the press, is it really freedom of the press?
I think there is a freedom of press, of course, in the United States. There is a very high level of freedom of press. But I think people are very disillusioned with institutions, and they see different media organizations as part of these institutions as well. And as such, they look at the different institutions such as Washington Post, New York Times, CNN, with the same disdain that they look at bigger companies like ExxonMobil or IBM or, Chase Manhattan Bank. So I think people are just not very trustful of institutions. And that's why we are going to citizen journalists in the site that we have, iranwire.com. It's both in both languages, Persian and English. We go to citizen journalists in Iran and we ask them to report to us. And we try to gain some trust by doing that, because I think people just don't believe in big institutions anymore. And it's a positive phenomenon, and at the same time, it's a negative phenomenon. It's a positive phenomenon because it is giving people that self-confidence to people that they have rights as citizens of different countries to express themselves, and they have certain sets of rights as citizens of the countries that they have to fight to gain those rights. But at the same time, it makes people in different countries, individuals in different countries, vulnerable to demagogues, to people who just through populist promises, they just mobilize a group of people and then they take over power.
Right.
And I think we've been to a country that something like that happens. I'm not sure what it is, but
Mazir, I'm, we'll wrap up here. But when you look back on your life, especially the experience in 2009 in prison in Iran for being accused of being a spy, how has that changed not only your personal life, but your professional life? How have you changed as a journalist from that experience?
I think I've become more of an activist journalist, because I think the attention that was paid to me through the campaign and through the book and the film, etc., it has given me a new audience, and I think I have a responsibility, and I cannot be just a neutral journalist anymore. And I've become an activist, and I somehow enjoy that role because there are not that many people who can do that. And, you know, it's made my life a bit more difficult, but at the same time, when you're in a solitary confinement, you see how limited your life is, that you have a very limited amount of time in this world, and you have to use that as good as possible. And I think I've become a better person because of that horrible experience.
Iranian-Canadian filmmaker, journalist, and human rights activist Mazir Bahari is the keynote speaker at the upcoming 2017 Risa K. Lambert Chicago Luncheon. It is a fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, the Sheraton Hotel, on Friday afternoon. The biggest fundraiser for the museum in the entire country. Over 2,000 people expected. The event also expected to raise over $5 million. Mazir, it's great to meet you. Great to hear your story. And thank you for coming in and talking to us about
Elvis. It was great to be in the fishbowl and with everyone looking at us. It was great talking to you. Thank you so much.